Today's Taisho will be on Case 23 in the Mu Meng Kang. Case 23 is entitled, Think Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth patriarch was pursued by Monk Myo as far as Tai Yu Mountain. The patriarch, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the faith. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please give me your instruction." The patriarch said, "Think neither good nor evil. At this very moment, what is the original self of Monk Myo?" At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and bowed, saying, "Besides the secret words and secret meaning you have just now revealed to me, is there anything else deeper still?" The patriarch said, "What I have told you is no secret at all. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deeper is found right there." Myo said, "I was with the monks under Mo Obai for many years, but I could not realize my true self. But now receiving your instruction, I know it is like a man drinking water and knowing whether it is cold or warm. My lay brother, you are now called my teacher." The patriarch said, "If you say so, but let us both call Obai our teacher. Be mindful to treasure and hold fast to what you have attained." Mumon's comment. The sixth patriarch was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It is as though he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse, you cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So this is day two of our January Sesshin. I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job this morning. This is a very famous scene in Zen tradition. First of all, though, let me just say that the word patriarch is not correct. I have to go through here and just cross out the word patriarch and put ancestor. Because patriarch is sort of gendered in a way that the Chinese word isn't gendered. The first six teachers in Zen tradition were called Zen ancestors. That's the closest word to the Chinese word. But when it was translated into English, they used the word patriarch. And I just want to go on record as saying it's not really a patriarch, it's an ancestor. Okay, this is a story about Wei Nang. And I mentioned Wei Nang a little bit yesterday. Wei Nang was the son of a bureaucrat who died prematurely. And in order to support his mother, Wei Nang had to sell firewood. According to the story about his life, he was not able to get a good education. He wasn't able to go to a good school, and so he was basically functionally illiterate, is the idea. He was taking care of his mother as a woodcutter, selling wood in the square. And then one day he heard a monk reciting lines from the Diamond Sutra, and the lines from the Diamond Sutra were basically, develop a nowhere dwelling mind, a mind that doesn't hold on to anything, see. And when Wei Ning heard these words, he was deeply, deeply stirred. And he resolved to do something, to act on that experience. And then when his mother died, he left and he went to study Zen at this temple, where this teacher, whose name was Obai, was teaching. And Wei Ning was not ordained. He was allowed to come into the temple, but not as a student. He was allowed to come into the temple and work in the kitchen as a laborer. You know, in China, there were very large monasteries by this time. And even if all the monks and nuns basically did chores all day long, it wasn't good enough sometimes for them to get everything done. So they did hire people in the area to do work for them. So this was not so unusual. They hired Wei Ning to work in the kitchen, and in those days, it was necessary to thresh the rice before you cooked it. So you actually had to take the husk off the rice, and that was done with a device that was where a man would sit and peddle, and he would sit and pedal like a little bicycle, and the gears would turn a threshing machine, which was like a basket, and the rice would go be turned around and around in this basket or in this drum, and gradually the chaff would separate from the kernel of rice. And he would do that day after day. So at any rate, Wei Ning was basically getting up every day and working out on this machine, and sometimes he would go into the Dokusan room when the teacher Obai was giving Dokusan. In the process of all of this, and based on his earlier experience of breakthrough, hearing the words from the Diamond Sutra, he began to form like a deep insight into who he really was. You could maybe think of working at this machine all day as kind of like meditation. You know, he would come in, sit down, and start pedaling his bicycle device, and threshing rice day in and day out, day in and day out. And sometimes he'd go in and listen to Obai give Teisho. Obai was finally becoming very old, and he knew he was going to die pretty soon. So he announced to all of his monks and nuns that he was going to make somebody head of the temple after he was, after he'd passed away. He asked everybody to compose a poem expressing their attainment, their insight into the way of Zen, or their insight into enlightened mind, you know. At this time, there was a very illustrious head monk whose name was in Chinese Shen Xiu. And Shen Xiu was like a very scholarly, very intelligent person, and highly accomplished as a scholar, and also highly accomplished as a practitioner. He was the head monk, and pretty much everybody thought that he was the one that Obai was going to make his heir when he died. He was going to pass on his authority to Obai. So even though Obai invited everyone to do to write a poem and post it on the pillars in the dining room, only Shen Xiu did one, because he was the star pupil of Obi, and he had all the right chops, right, for the job. And all the other monks and nuns thought, well, look, you know, Obi is so clearly, Shensyu is so clearly Obi's number one guy. Why bother to write a poem? You know, we know that Shensyu has the deepest insight of anybody here. So, you know, Shensyu was not a bad guy at all. He was really a very deeply accomplished and compassionate person. And so there was every reason for Obi to look well on Shensyu, and all the monks and nuns admired him. Shensyu composed his poem, and he put it on a pillar. And the poem basically said, the mind is like a mirror, and dust gathers on the mirror, and you have to keep the dust off by cleaning the mirror all the time so that its radiant nature will shine forth. Basically, that was Shensyu's poem. Everybody saw it on the pillar, on one of the pillars in the dining hall, and admired it because it was so true, right? I mean, we have to do our Zazen practice on a regular basis. If we don't, our minds become clouded. We are purifying ourselves here at Sesshin, body, mind, and heart. It makes so much sense. So everybody thought, well, Shensyu is going to be the head of the temple. But in the meantime, you know, Wei Nang was still toiling away in the kitchen, threshing rice and helping prepare the meals. And he heard about this contest, or this, I guess it is a contest, you know. Wei Nang said to one of the cooks in the kitchen, one of the monk cooks, listen, I'd like to enter too. And the monk who was in the kitchen laughed and said, you know, you're just this squirt who, you know, grinds rice all day. And Wei Nang said, well, all the same, if you would just take down the dictation, because you know I can't even read and write. So anyway, Wei Nang dictated a poem to this monk, and it basically said, there is no mirror, and there is no dust. You know, from the beginning, not a thing is. And the monk who wrote this thought, what the hell? You know, what's that all about? But he wrote it, and he copied it down, and to please this guy who was this obscure little guy working in the kitchen, he put it on the pillar in the dining hall. And anyway, the time came for Obi to judge all the poems. And there's these poems are called gatha in Buddhist tradition. Enlightenment poems. He came out of his abbot's quarters, and he noticed that there were just two poems hanging on the pillar, and he read Shensyu's, and it said, you know, the mind is like a mirror that we have to keep clean. We have to clean the dust away, and then its luminous nature will shine forth, basically. And then he went over to look at Wei Nang's poem. And he didn't say anything, right? And anyway, he went back into his room. And he called Wei Nang into his room in the dead of night. And he said, you know, you have the deepest insight of anybody here in the temple. He said, you know, I have to say, you know, you have really deeply understood the great way. But if I go out there and I tell everybody that you are my Dharma heir, and that I'm giving the robe and the bowl to you, they're going to lynch you, or they're going to lynch me, you know. I mean, they probably wouldn't really have lynched anybody, but this is sort of for dramatic effect, you know. So the point is, the abbot basically felt that all of these monks and nuns had been working so hard for so many years, and Xianxue had been doing so many good things to keep the community going, and here's this little guy who basically isn't even a monk, and Obai said, I can't really give you the robe and the bowl in public, but I'm going to give them to you right now. Here they are, and you should just leave here and go and go teach Zen somewhere else. And so by night, Wei Neng leaves and goes away. And in the morning, everybody hears that Obai's robe and bowl are gone. And they start talking among each other and saying, well, the robe and the bowl are gone. Well, those were supposed to go to Xianxue. And then they notice that the cook's assistant, Wei Neng, is missing. And so they come to the conclusion that he stole it. You know, he must have stolen it. You know, and so then there's this guy who is named Myo. And Myo was actually like a general. He was like a very high-ranking military official who gave up his commission and became a monk. And when the community decided that Wei Neng had absconded with the robe and the bowl that were passed down from the Buddhist time, Myo said, well, I'm just the guy to catch this crook. You know, I'm a general. You know, I'm good at tracking and so on. So he leaves the monastery and he goes after Wei Neng. And he is good at tracking. And he follows Wei Neng's trail. And eventually he encounters Wei Neng on Tai Yu Mountain. And Wei Neng is resting by some water, and General Myo charges him. And he's going to grab the robe and the bowl, but when he tries to pick them up, they won't budge. And he has like a little, he has a Kensho experience. He says, I tried to move your robe and bowl, but they were as heavy as a mountain, and he starts trembling. He has like a little crisis, and he realizes that Wei Neng is not a regular person, and he says, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please give me instruction." And then what Wei Neng says is, "Think neither good nor evil. At this moment, what is the original self of Monk Myo?" So that's basically the story. That's a little bit more than the koan gives you. The koan is entitled "Think Neither Good Nor Evil," and it's possible to misunderstand. You know, all of the monks and nuns at the temple followed the precepts. And so, basically the precepts involve not doing anything ethically incorrect. And people who become a monk or become a nun hold themselves to very, very high standards of ethical conduct. For Wei Neng to say, "Think neither good nor evil," that's kind of a shocking statement in the context of Buddhism, which puts a very strong emphasis on morality. So the koan is a kind of a complicated koan in many ways. But it's not just about good and evil. I often think about General Myo, because he's a very typical kind of person in, I think, our society. You know, I work in an English department, and if you know anything about English departments, they're not what you would think at all. You know, my father, when he heard that I was an English professor, he just thought, he said, "Oh, what a wonderful life, you know. You just read poetry, read good literature." You know, I think he had this image of, you know, my life where, you know, I meet my students and we talk about Shakespeare, or we talk about this and that, and then, you know, I have office hours and I'm smoking my pipe and students come in and go, "Well, what do you think? What about Cordelia? You know, is that truly, you know?" And we talk about Hamlet, you know. Let's talk about Hamlet for a while, you know. And then, you know, the faculty would get together at a faculty meeting and we'd all, you know, "Have you read this new poem? Oh, I love it. You know, it's beautiful." You know, and my father was a military officer, you know, so he had been through war too. He had, you know, pretty rough. He had been in Vietnam. He was in Vietnam for 6 years. So, you know, I think he thought of my life as paradise, you know, and it is in some ways a very nice life. But, you know, when I got to Rutgers, you know, basically, people are very, very hard charging and very competitive. You know, I got my job. I got my job when my predecessor resigned in a huff because he wasn't given a promotion. And one of the first things he told me, when I got to my office, I noticed he hadn't cleared out any of his stuff. I said, "Aren't you going to clear out your stuff?" And he said, "No, I don't think that's necessary." What he meant was, "You're never going to succeed at this job, you know." So I've been in that office for 30 years, so it didn't work out the way he planned. But, you know, it didn't take me long to realize that, you know, even an English department can be very competitive and a very hard-driving place. You know, in English departments, just like everywhere else, people have a pecking order, you know. So you might think you're either a professor or you're not a professor, but it's actually not like that. There's actually there's something called an assistant professor. There's something called an associate professor. There's something called a professor, and then that's not even good enough. There's something called a distinguished professor. You know, so there's all these different ranks in the English department, and they're based on basically how much you publish, how many papers you give, if your work is cited. You know, they actually do they do Google searches to see how often your work is cited. And so, you know, actually this produces people who are very competitive and very deeply insecure, you know. You know, I was talking to a person. I was just at a conference, an English teachers conference, and I was talking to a person who had, and he said he was telling me that one of his articles had been cited 600 times, and that is very impressive. But I thought, why are you telling me this? You know, I just met you. Hello, I'm so and so, and my articles have been cited 600 times. You know. And this is an English department, right? You know, it's not like the stakes are that high, you know. But even in an English department, there's a pecking order. People are always on the lookout for. They want to be a little better than the next guy, and people put tremendous pressure on themselves. One of my friends is in the history department, and he just retired. And we were having lunch together, and he said, "Yeah, you know, I never made it to distinguished professor." And this is a guy who's worked for almost, I guess, for 40 years in the history department. He's published like 5 books or something. You know, he's worked his ass off. And he's going out of his career feeling like he didn't quite make the grade. And that's so sad, right? But anyway, You know, this mentality is everywhere in our society. And it can also be in the Zendo. You know, it can also be in the Zendo. In many Zen communities, people get different color. The thing that Sandy and I wear around our necks is called a roksu. And basically, it's actually a monk's robe. It's like a little monk's robe that you wear around your neck. It's like a portable monk's robe, basically. And Scott has one also, and Egbert has one. And it's a statement of your commitment to the path. In some temples, different people wear different colored roksu, right? So, like the Roshi will have a roksu that's embroidered. It's very beautiful, right? But nobody else is allowed to have an embroidered roksu except the Roshi. And then there's different colors. It's like in martial arts where there's like a black belt and a yellow belt. And you know what's happening is that into Zen is creeping in this kind of competitiveness, right? You know, it's like, I only have a brown roksu. He had a scarlet roksu, and that's a very on Zen, I think, very not the spirit of Zen practice at all. It can creep into Zen practice. There's a kind of pecking order that can happen in Zen communities too, and I'm very happy that we haven't really gone in that direction, But there's a deeper aspect to all of this, which is that people can be very competitive with each other, but they can be very competitive with themselves. You know, our culture. I'm a teacher. When students go to school, they get grades, and so the performance of something you do is assessed in terms of a grade, right? And, everybody in a class is not supposed to get an A. You know, so there's something called a curve. So, actually, in especially at universities, you're not supposed to give everybody an A. You're supposed to give, a few, like 20% A's, 40% B's, 20% C's, or something like that. Depends on the subject, but you're supposed to get a grade distribution. Everybody shouldn't cluster around the A, or you're not doing your job. So you're supposed to make the learning situation competitive, and you're supposed to make it all about getting a good grade. And so unconsciously, all the students in the room, they're nice to each other, but they also, in a certain way, also know that they're competitors with each other, like in a chemistry class where people are going into medical school. Produces people who aren't always supportive of one another, but it also produces people who aren't necessarily supportive of themselves, So there's a way of practicing Zen that probably many people have, where you're trying to be like getting a good grade. You're trying to get a good grade, and you're judging yourself very harshly if your performance isn't up to standard, or if you're not really becoming a quote unquote like a brilliant Zen student. And this is very common and actually quite unhealthy. It's possible to turn Zen into another kind of self-judging, self-punishing regimen, right? So when I first started doing Zen, I was a real nerd in high school, and I always tried to get good grades. I wasn't always interested in the subject matter. I was more interested in the grades, And when I didn't get a good grade, I would often like really be mad at myself. So if I had a test and I didn't get an A on the calculus test or something, or my algebra test, I would really be mad at myself. Almost like I didn't, you know, hurt myself physically, but I was definitely emotionally sort of punishing myself. In a way the system worked, right? Because I did get good grades most of the time. But I wasn't really liberated by my studies, you know. When I started doing Zen practice, it was like that too. I really wanted to be an excellent Zen student. And I really put a lot of pressure on myself. So when I would go into Genki Roshi and I wouldn't pass my koan, I would feel very sad and upset, like I had gotten a D on my grades, you know. And it took me a long time to get through that. And there are people who have studied with me in the past who actually have left just because they just didn't feel like they were successful. They weren't passing enough koans or something like that. And that really does poison your practice, you know. So it's very important to practice in the right way, in the right way. Zen practice is not about being, it's not about strength of will. It's not about strength of will. It's not about being the strongest person in the room or being able to endure the greatest suffering. That's not Zen practice. That's a form of samsara or illusion. Zen practice is really all about being open to whatever comes. It's just being open to the possibilities of whatever comes. And if you think about Zen as like this ordeal, you have to punish yourself, really work hard, burn the midnight oil, and sit until you get the payoff. That's not a liberating situation. It's much better to practice as a kind of with a trusting mind. Practice with a trusting mind. You're not here to whip yourself into shape. You're here to open up and be trusting. So, I tried to be a good student, and I actually in Zen, and I actually kind of gave up, but I enjoyed practicing, so I didn't quit. I was studying with Genki Roshi, and I would go into Dokusan, and I couldn't seem to answer my koans. And I did entertain very seriously the possibility of quitting, but then I just realized, Zen has helped me so much psychologically that I can't imagine not continuing to just at least go to the Zen Center, and then I continued to go to Sesshin. But I sort of just gave up on the possibility of being a really good Zen student. And when I did sort of give up on my dream of being like Zen master or something, I began to really enjoy my Zen practice, It's okay not to know what you're doing. In fact, that's the very best condition. This is all about being open to the possibilities. We don't know what's going to happen at Sesshin. And that's why this is liberating, because you're opening up to whatever is going to happen next, and you're trying to be one with what is happening. And that's the opposite of like strength of will, or if you find yourself fighting, on the cushion with your practice, you're not fighting with your practice, you're fighting with yourself. And your motivation isn't enlightenment, your motivation is something else. And I don't know what it is, but you know, obviously you're trying to get the upper hand over your life in some way, and you're trying to win at life, and using Zen to win at life, if that makes any sense. It's like, you know, you can't practice very successfully that way. Zen is about, really, it sounds like a cliche, but it really is about going with the flow. You know, and you really do have to just sit down on the cushion and surrender yourself to the process, trust the process. And, you know, the more you try to make things happen, the more physical pain and the more your pain will bother you. And the less likely you are to begin to have real breakthroughs in your practice. You know, it's definitely the case that for me, I had really just given up. You know, I just thought, you know, when I started training with Genki Roshi, he had just come from Japan, and all of these students came, and we would go to Sesshin, and everybody would go into Dokusan, and they'd leave Sesshin with a big smile on their face, you know, and people weren't supposed to talk about it, but they would talk about the koans they passed. And it would be, koans? You passed more than one? You know, oh my God. You know, I've been going for 2 years and I haven't passed a koan, you know. And I wouldn't say that. I would just quietly go, oh yeah, it's great to pass a koan or something like that. You know, not that I knew, right? But it you know, I as I said, I kind of thought, well, maybe I'll just bag this. But, you know, I was so engaged by it, you know. And then I just, you know, just gave up and just kept practicing, you know, without a goal necessarily in mind or any kind of, you know, my dreams of being a great Zen master went up in smoke, you know. But then... things began to. I began to be able to have experiences on the cushion that were truly liberating, because I wasn't punishing myself when I didn't meet my high standards. You know, I wasn't trying to win. And this is like crucially important to Zen practice. You know, this is not about strength of will. It's not about fighting it out with the pain. It's about it's about becoming one with your true nature, right? And that just requires a kind of like this super intensive giving up, right? Weineng, you know, basically had nothing going for him. And yet he became deeply awake. He didn't have the money to go and practice at a temple, but he was motivated by a great desire to wake up, and basically also by some kind of remarkable openness. You know, Weineng was able to be awake when people sitting 12 hours a day weren't able to be awake, you know. And maybe it was just that he had no expectations for or against anything. But the little story of Weineng is really saying, you know, he didn't choose anything that happened to him. He just presented himself wholeheartedly at each moment of his life. You know, so it wasn't the case that when he was an illiterate woodcutter, he said, you know, someday I am going to be the first Chinese Zen teacher, and you know, thousands of temples will, you know, spring up, you know, from my teachings. You know, that never crossed his mind. He just tried to be present in the moment with what was happening. And even though Shen Xiu was a great, learned, and diligent practitioner, you know, his. And even though his poem is true in a certain way, you know, we do have to come into the Zendo. We do have to sit down. But the idea that there's all this dust that we have to clean up day after day makes it a fight. Right? It makes it a fight. It's a big fight. Fundamentally, there's something wrong. our mirrors keep getting dusty, and we've got to fight against the dust. You know, we've got to fight that. And that mentality of struggle poisons everything. And Wei Neng says, you know, there's no mirror and there's no dust. You know, fundamentally, those are just illusions. And if you can encounter that spirit, it's so liberating, right? You are already a Buddha. That's the Zen teaching, is you are already a Buddha. So, basically, we're here to bathe in our Buddha nature. We're here to sort of appreciate and revel in and soak in our Buddha nature. And yes, you know, pain is in your legs. You know, I have pain in my legs too, you know. But I can't control it, you know. Some mornings I get up and I sit down and I just have a wonderful pain-free sit, and some days I have some pain. And, you know, I can't make the pain go away. I can't command it to go away. So I just try to empty myself out. You know, I just try to be empty. And on the cushion, I just watch the breath and I try to empty out. And if I empty out, you know, some interesting things happen, you know. And the pain doesn't go away 100%, you know, but it's not unbearable if I'm not trying to win over my pain. It's just there. You know, it's there too, you know. But Zen practice, what makes Zen practice quote-unquote hard is that we want to try. We want to win. And what we really have to do is get out of our own way. You know, we just have to, in a way, you just have to be willing to be soft, you know, actually. You know, there was a great Zen master who was asked, what is Zen? And he just said, you know, Zen is tender-heartedness, you know. So, if you practice in a spirit of tender-heartedness, good things are going to happen, right? I mean, of course we have pain. We're sitting here for 8 hours a day. Our legs are going to hurt. My poor legs, you know. Being in pain is sort of a human thing, right? I mean, anything you do is going to cause you some pain in life, you know. If you write a book, you know, when I had to write this book to get tenure at Rutgers, and if I didn't write the book, I was going to be fired, basically, you know. So I had a powerful incentive to write this book, you know. And I wrote that book, you know, I would sit so many hours, I would get up, meditate, and every other day I would go for a jog, and then I would write. You know, and I'd go to the library and read and come back and write. And I did that for like 100 days or something straight, you know. By the time I was done, I could barely, you know, my back hurt. I had so many back problems from sitting at this word processor. And I would be almost like, they didn't have laptops in those days. If they had, I would have, you know, lay on my back or something, you know, because I was in so much pain. So even writing a book causes you physical pain, you know. So, one way to experience pain is to say, I shouldn't be having this pain. This is an indignity. Another way to deal with pain is to say, I've got to get the better of my pain. I've got to beat it, you know, and you'll never win. And another way is saying, oh, you know, this is so human, right? You know, and this is part of being a human being. You know, we have a little pain. You know, so much of our, most of our obstacles in Zen are caused by our unwillingness to be small and be empty. You know, my second teacher, Webb, used to say, make yourself small. And that's such good advice, right? You know, just be small, be ordinary, be empty. Empty yourself out on the cushion and be present with what's happening. You know, get in the koan and let it carry you where it's going to go. You just have to be present. You know, that's all you have to do. Nothing that happened to Wei Neng did he choose. It all happened, you know, as according to the way of the Tao, right? You know, And that's true for us too. You know, at the end of your life, you're not going to look back and say, oh, it was exactly the way I planned it. You know, that, nobody I know has a life like that. The thing is to be open to the possibilities. So please keep this story in mind as you're practicing. The art of Zen is not, you know, it's not about think neither, it says neither good nor evil. Another way to put it is think neither success nor failure. Think neither success nor failure. The sixth ancestor was pursued by the monk Myo as far as Tai Yu Mountain. The ancestor, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the faith. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not the robe. I beg you, give me instruction." So, you know, Myo is a fighter. He's a soldier. He's used to fight, fight, fight. But that's not the way. You know, the way is to be soft, be small, you know, empty yourself out. Could we have a bell, please? Thank you.